Welcome to the program for Wednesday, January 25th, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour, we bring you Pentagon Solutions, and today no exception. Pentagon Solutions is our deep dive conversation series where we talk to experts on defense issues from both inside and outside the Pentagon. They share ideas that leaders inside the building and leaders in the contracting community can use to solve the big challenges the defense community faces. And the goal is to deliver information that will show you a path to those Pentagon solutions. Military.com last week reporting that an influential Washington think tank called Tuesday for the U.S. military to redraw its map of bases throughout the Middle East to keep out a range of new Iranian weapons that could threaten American troops. Now, that story by John Reed says, in a new report, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments warned that Tehran's investment in anti-ship and precision-guided missiles designed to strike targets throughout the region, combined with sophisticated air defense systems, means the U.S. may have to shift its presence in the region in the coming decade. John Reed continues on military.com. Mark Gunzinger briefed reporters Tuesday morning on his new report, Outside In, Operating from Range to Defeat Iran's Anti-Access and Area Denial Threats. The brief was noteworthy because CSBA's ideas and recommendations have a way of becoming Pentagon policy. Several years ago, CSBA recommended an air-sea battle concept that focused on building long-range carrier-launched stealthy UAVs, a family of long-range strike systems, a cyber buildup, and a number of dispersed bare-bones bases in the Pacific where U.S. forces could scatter in the event of a war with China. Many of these recommendations have found their way into the Pentagon's strategy and budgets. That's the writing of John Reed on military.com. This conversation about U.S. military force structure in the Middle East is especially timely because of the release of the Pentagon's new strategy about 2 weeks ago, and we're expecting details any day now about the fiscal 2013 budget request that Secretary Panetta has said will flesh out the execution of that strategy. So I'm very pleased today to welcome to Pentagon Solutions the authors of the report Outside In, Operating from Range to Defeat Iran's Anti-Access and Area Denial Threats, Mark Gunzinger, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and Chris Dougherty, a Research Fellow at CSBA. Gentlemen, it's great to have you in the studio today.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in to talk to me about this today. We have a link to the report at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And I want to start with tying what you're writing about in this report to the air-sea battle concept that John Reed was alluding to. Chris, I'll start with you. What is the connection? How are the two concepts, specifically what you're writing about for Iran and more broadly air-sea battle, how are they connected?
Francis, they're connected by the they're designed both to counter anti-access area denial strategies, ultimately, and they're both operational concepts designed to do that. And I think I'd actually turn this over to Mark so he could discuss the broader theory of the case of anti-access area denial strategies, and then when we get into the specifics of the Iranian case, I'll come back and
Excellent.
Talk about that a little bit more.
Mark?
Yes, anti-access air denial strategies, as we call them, and as DOD has described them, are designed to prevent the U.S. military from projecting power effectively into a region of operations to attack our networks, our space-based capabilities, our forces at sea, on land, and in the air, to delay their arrival, essentially giving our adversary time to achieve their theater objectives, be it aggression against a neighbor or other objectives. As for the connection, we first wrote an air-sea battle candidate operational concept for the Western Pacific in 2010, and we followed this year by releasing a candidate concept for the Persian Gulf area. Are they connected? Well, yes, they are in terms of many of the concepts underlying the two documents, the two assessments that we completed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's very important to understand that air-sea battle, as it has been discussed in public, is not all about the Western Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concept for addressing these anti-access air denial, or as we'll call them, A2AD mm-hmm. strategies and capabilities being fielded in several different theaters. Nor is the concept for the Persian Gulf area, it's not a subset of an air-sea battle-like concept for the Western Pacific. You have to account for the different geographies. The enemy is different. They think differently. They train differently. They have different capabilities than our allies and partners in various regions are different as well.
A lot of our conversation is going to revolve around the A2AD concept, and so I'd like you to dig into that a little bit more. You talked about it briefly, but I'd like you to expand on it a little bit more. Give me a kind of a definition of anti-access area denial, what the term means.
Okay, anti-access is, you can think of the use of longer-range weapons as well as weapons that could attrit our forces in space or our satellite constellations in space, as well as cyberspace capabilities that would delay U.S. force deployments into a theater of operations. Anti-area denial is more about limiting U.S. military's freedom of action in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
So that would involve the development of advanced integrated air defense systems as well as other kinetic and non-kinetic capabilities to prevent freedom of maneuver at sea, ability of our aircraft to penetrate an enemy's airspace or operate in target areas to attack critical targets.
And when you said kinetic and non-kinetic, you kind of anticipated my next question, which is, it sounds like this applies to any form of conflict, including what we're hearing a lot more now about in the cyber realm.
I think that's a key point. We're not talking about necessarily high-end conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of discussion recently about, well, is this a high-end or a low-end conflict? And frankly, we think that kind of a distinction is losing its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last 20, 25 years, in theater operations we've engaged in, we've operated in relatively permissive environments. Our bases were not under attack,
mm-hmm.
or at least they weren't the focus of a major attack by the enemy. Our networks were secure. Our logistics lines of communication to a theater were secure. We had dominance in the air, or we were at least able to achieve that relatively quickly, and we didn't have to worry too much about our space-based assets. That's changing today with the development of precision-guided munitions and their proliferation of state and non-state actors globally. So we're saying this permissive environment that, frankly, we've experienced over the last, well, since the end of the Cold War, is going to become increasingly non-permissive in the future in all operating domains,
mm-hmm.
air, space, cyberspace, ground, sea, and undersea as well.
Is that a hard point to get across to the people who need to understand it, both inside and outside the Pentagon, that this environment is shifting from permissive to non-permissive, as you call it, and isn't likely to shift back, that this is a new environment in which military will be operating for the foreseeable future?
Well, let me give you the perfect Pentagon answer, yes and no. It's actually not a concept that would be challenged by just about anyone I've talked to in DoD. They understand that the environment is becoming increasingly non-permissive,
mm-hmm.
in nature. Translating that to actual changes in resource priorities and programs, what they're going to buy, therein lies the rub.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more difficult because DoD has invested in a lot of programs over the last 10, 20 years that have delivered or will deliver capabilities that might not be optimized for operations in very non-permissive environments,
mm-hmm.
the kind that we see emerging in the Western Pacific, and we believe will and is emerging in the Persian Gulf.
The implications for all of this, the part of it that I think I find the most interesting is, what does this mean for the procurement chain? What does this mean for the development of weapon systems when you need different stuff than you theoretically have and even have in the pipeline? That's what we'll talk about a little bit when we come back from the break on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guests on In Depth with Francis Rose today on Pentagon Solutions, Mark Gunzinger and Chris Doherty of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
Navy Rear Admiral. Admiral Retired Elizabeth A. Height, Vice President, U.S. Public Sector Cybersecurity Practice, HP Enterprise Services, on the Cybersecurity Combating Threats to Our Software Environment panel, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard.
We look at applications and software development from an architectural view today. At least we should, because quite frankly, it's so much easier to design security in than to find the thousands or tens of thousands of vulnerabilities that might exist in that software at a later date once deployed.
Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective, and that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications. HP can help governments secure mission-critical applications by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. To learn more, visit federalnewsradio.com/HP.
The Department of Defense update is brought to you by ITT Excellus.
The federal government's second-largest solar energy project is underway in the Mojave Desert. The Navy broke ground on the project last week at China Lake Naval Air Weapons Station in Southern California. When it's finished, the array will generate over 13 megawatts of electricity. The Navy's giving a solar provider access to 118 acres of land at no charge. They can buy the energy generated at a discount. The Navy says they'll save about $13 million over the 20-year contract.
A new company with more than 50 years of experience, ITT Defense is now ITT Excellus. The reliable, flexible partner you've come to know is now tightly focused on providing innovative, essential C4 ISR solutions and information and technical services. A new name in aerospace and defense, they're already a global top 20 leader. Work with a true partner, ready to solve your challenges with situational agility and a record of rapidly fielding affordable solutions. Experience the power of ingenuity at ExcellusInc.com.
To win and deliver government contracts successfully, you need to align with the right teaming partners. Meet Tech Systems. While often behind the scenes, Tech Systems has worked with government agencies and systems integrators for over 25 years. In fact, every year, they deploy over 70,000 IT professionals at over 5,500 client sites nationwide, including more than 65 government agencies. Tech Systems is active across a broad spectrum of government programs and has developed deep relationships who understand what works well and who does it best. Thinking about cybersecurity, working on a cloud computing initiative. Tech Systems addresses critical program gaps related to people, projects, and work functions. Their delivery models scale from staff augmentation to IT project and outsourcing services to support transition, ramp-up, surge, and ongoing program support needs. Learn more at TechSystems.com. TEKSystems.com.
Tom Temin here with a preview of tomorrow's Federal Drive. Veterans Affairs has had success with a health records technology called Blue Button. Now OPM wants all federal websites to have a Blue Button. VA's tech chief tells us what it's all about. Plus quantum cryptography. It's hardly a household word, but it soon might be on your cell phone. Those stories and more tomorrow morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today on Pentagon Solutions, talking to Mark Gunzinger and Chris Doherty of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and the release of a publication from them called the Outside In, Operating from Range to Defeat Iran's Anti-Access and Area Denial Threats. Before the break, we were talking about some of the cultural changes that changes in strategy are driving at the Pentagon. Mark, what overall, you talk a little bit broadly about the reception and the yes and no answer about how people are receiving this. Dig into that a little bit deeper and talk about some of the changes that you think may have to happen in order for this to permeate below the upper level where you're saying people are seeing this already.
Right. To a large extent, the defense community writ large is thinking about these problems, the problem of anti-access air denial capabilities and the strategies that are being adopted in the Pacific and in the Persian Gulf. In fact, the new strategic guidance that came out, what, about 2 weeks ago actually made the point that one of the primary missions of the U.S. military will be to project power despite anti-access and area denial challenges.
I think, though, I'd say one of the areas in which there's been a little bit more difficulty in reaching an acceptance about anti-access area denial strategies has been in the ground forces, given their focus, obviously, over the last decade on counterinsurgency operations. There's a belief in the building and in the defense community that A2AD is a China problem, it's an Air Force, it's a Navy problem. Mm-hmm. And really what we see is that actually with the proliferation of precision-guided weapons, A2AD could actually become an Army and a Marine Corps problem rather quickly. And we saw in the 2006 Lebanon war between Israel and Hezbollah the impact, the operational impact that precision-guided munitions could have in the hands of a non-state actor. There's been a lot of thinking over the last 5 years as to what that might mean for U.S. forces going forward. And in particular, it's really instructive to look at that as regards Iran's A2AD strategy, because it's quite different than that that's being implemented by the PLA in the Western Pacific. Iran is implementing what we call in the report A2AD strategy, A2AD being a shorthand for anti-access area denial strategy with Persian characteristics. And really it's a asymmetric or hybrid A2AD strategy. It's not designed to go against U.S. forces in a pure force-on-force manner. They're actually trying to be much more coercive, much more indirect. They want to use their ballistic missiles, their anti-ship cruise missiles, their proxy forces to coerce local regional governments into denying U.S. forces access to bases and overflight rights. Mm-hmm. And that would severely complicate our operational planning for conducting operations in the Persian Gulf region.
Sure.
And if Iran could successfully coerce a Qatar, a Bahrain, a UAE into denying us basing access or overflight rights, suddenly the United States' operational flexibility becomes much more constrained. You're limited to a much smaller number of places to base from, to operate out of, much more limited flight patterns. So I think you have to really reconsider what we mean by A2AD strategy. I mean, the overarching strategy is the same, but the implementation of it is different in mm-hmm. this region, and it takes advantage of the unique characteristics of the region.
So they're essentially trying to buy themselves a little bit of breathing room to build a shield around behind which they can operate in the manner in which they choose to operate, and where they then would believe they could operate with confidence that we would have a lot more difficult time if it were not impossible
right.
for us
and
to
I,
reach them.
I think the straits affords them, the Strait of Hormuz affords them a barrier, a choke point at which to sort of narrow off the ability of U.S. forces to penetrate. And I think, they are able to do that at a much lower cost because of that narrow choke point. They don't have to develop the same systems that China has to develop to defend over the really broad range of the Western Pacific.
Mm-hmm. What's the implication of the pirate incident where we retrieved some Iranian personnel from a ship in the Strait? What was last week? How does that fit into all of this that you're talking about, writing about, Mark?
I think we actually rescued a couple of seamen.
Yeah.
The point there is not only are we present, and we have a pretty good picture of that area 24/7,
mm-hmm.
but also we're not there to aggress. We're there to maintain a stable balance in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes rescuing seamen who are in distress,
mm-hmm.
frankly. It's our military has a very valuable peacetime role in that region. It's not all about maintaining freedom of access, freedom of navigation in the region.
Mm-hmm. That episode kind of highlighted again the tension between the United States and Iran. Was that a factor? I'm sure it was, but what were the other factors in you choosing to write on this subject to address this issue now?
Let me go back in history just about 30 years, 1979, in 80 time frame. We had a situation where we had the Iranian Revolution. We lost a partner in the region that helped maintain a stable balance. We had a Soviet Union who was making noises about the Persian Gulf and gaining access, direct access to its energy supplies. And, of course, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan later in 1979. You had a number of factors that I think led to DoD taking a hard look at its preparedness for potential future contingency operations in the Persian Gulf. The conclusion was, we're not very well prepared back then. So they set in motion a series of initiatives to change your posture, to establish preposition materials that deploying forces could fall in on very quickly, to establish new bases in the region, and to actually design a concept that would use rapidly arriving air forces to that could stop an invading force, be it a Soviet force, Iranian force, or later on Iraqi force, from aggressing against GCC states. And to a large extent, that's the way we've operated over the last 20 years. And we've assumed that bases, close-in bases in the Persian Gulf, would be available. We'd be able to deploy our fighters and bombers into the region. We would be able to conduct air refueling operations very close to the border of an enemy, that our networks would be secure, that we would have our logistics lines of communication secured through the Strait of Hormuz. And what we're saying in our report is, as we look to the future, the answer, all those assumptions may not be valid. And this is the reason why we actually wrote the report. It's not just about increased tensions in the region. It's about the trend line, what Iran is doing to actually mature this strategy and develop the capabilities to execute it. Today, they can't execute it effectively against the U.S. military that's second to none. But there are a lot of changes going on in the region, as there were in 1979. We have the Arab Spring. The U.S. military has redeployed from Iraq. You have, of course, Iran, who's developing new capabilities and aspire to nuclear weapons. So we are saying that today is a good time. We're at another pivot point. We ought to take another hard look at our plans, our capabilities, our preparedness for future contingency operations in that region.
My assumption is that by choosing them as the focus of this, that they are regarded broadly as the primary potential threat in that region. What are the other potential threats in that region that makes the entire Middle East region part of the focus, as Secretary Panetta and General Dempsey mentioned when they talked about rolling out the new strategy?
Well, I think we, in the report, we talk about Iran's coercive strategy, which is that they would use political and military means to coerce our partners and allies in the region to deny us basing rights and overflight access. But I think political instability could achieve much the same effect. You know, I don't want to postulate as to the relative political stability of any nation in the region, but as we saw with the Arab Spring, you know, at the drop of a hat, you know, a region, a state that was previously, you know, seen as a bulwark, quite stable in Egypt, went overnight into, you know, the government sort of within a matter of months was swept from power. And so I think you could see a dynamic like that play out, wherein, you know, kind of a staunch U.S. ally, much like Iran was in 1978, could within the span of a year or so suddenly transition into being a pretty hardcore enemy. And, I think the United States right now, its facing posture in the region has put a lot of eggs in not very many baskets. And I think one of the things we talk about in this report is diversifying that posture so that a disruption to any one part of the system doesn't lead to the fundamental collapse of the U.S. position in the Persian Gulf.
Well, let's talk about that when we come back, the diversification element of this and the eggs in baskets issue. We'll do that when we continue our conversation on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The title of this report is Outside In, Operating from Range to Defeat Iran's Anti-Access and Area Denial Threats, released by the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and the authors of that report, Mark Gunzinger and Chris Doherty, are with me on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back.
On November 17, 2011, the future of air and missile defense changed forever. MEADS, the Medium Extended Air Defense System, demonstrated the first-ever over-the-shoulder launch against a simulated target. It was an unprecedented breakthrough and proved that only MEADS, with its 360-degree coverage, can defend our warfighters against air and missile defense threats from any direction. MEADS has the advanced capabilities and reliability that the 40-year-old Patriot system can't provide, and will cost half as much to man and maintain versus upgrading Patriot. Meade's 360-degree coverage defends more area with fewer assets and has the lethality to defeat advanced threats. Defending more, costing less. Meade's. For more information, go to Meads-AMD.com. That's Meads-AMD.com.
Paid for by Lockheed Martin.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit MyVillageGreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Garden of Life and Boron.
Are you a loyal credit card user and your only reward is a high interest rate? Looking for a provider you can trust? With a State Department Federal Credit Union credit card, you'll not only earn reward points, but you'll also have one of the lowest credit card rates around. With a low rate and no hidden fees, you'll enjoy all the benefits of owning a credit card without the high cost to you. Plus, earn one reward point for every dollar you spend. Points can be redeemed for travel, dining, appliances, and more. Call 1-800-296-8882 or visit sdfcu.org to learn more. Unlock the rewards today.
Hi, welcome to Best Buy. Interested in boomboxes?
Yeah, I just got the iPhone 4S, and I want a docking system for when I'm at home.
Easy answer. The Insignia boombox with HD radio technology receives all the HD2, HD3 channels here in town and has iTunes tagging for your iPhone 4S.
Oh, yeah, iTunes tagging is cool. Tag and buy songs you hear on HD radio stations.
Yep, and it's only $99.
Wow, $99 and works with iPhone 4S? Lead the way.
Learn about HD radio technology at HDradio.com. More radio, more value.
Caregivers Self-Care. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. If you're giving care to a family member who is seriously ill, it's also important to take care of yourself. Being a family caregiver is a big job that often comes on top of other work and home responsibilities, so it's important to watch your stress. Recreation therapy specialist Renee Stubbs works at the National Institutes of Health's Clinical Center. She sees family caregivers all the time and tries to be a support for them as they care for their loved ones undergoing treatment at the research hospital.
I encourage them to make sure that they do things that are self-sustaining and self-caring. Relaxation. Make sure you're eating properly. Make sure you're getting enough rest and sleep.
Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is the Capital Area Food Bank. Sitting down to three meals a day shouldn't be a choice, but over 640,000 residents in the National Capital Region are forced to choose daily. Record numbers of families and children are struggling to get enough food to eat. Help the Capital Area Food Bank feed our neighbors in need. For more information, visit federalnewsradio.com. This message brought to you by Papa John's and Federal News Radio.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Chris Doherty and Mark Gunzinger of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments are my guests on Pentagon Solutions today. They are the co-authors of a report called Outside In, Operating from Range to Defeat Iran's Anti-Access and Area Denial Threats. And we're talking not just about what they're writing about Iran, but how it applies more broadly to DOD. And you can find all the resources, including the actual report, slide deck from a presentation about this report, linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Mark, we were talking a little bit during the break, during the commercials, about this issue of diversification and what is in the report. Talk about that a little bit and what that implies for compared to what we're doing over there now.
Sure. If I could make one quick point, follow up on what we were talking about earlier.
Yes.
In our 2010 Air-Sea Battle Report, we used the PLA in China as the pacing threat, as an example of a much more mature anti-access air denial challenge than what we see today in the Persian Gulf. Yet we use Iran as the pacing threat for the Persian Gulf, not the Iran of today, but the Iran where they could be 10 to 15 years from now. I think that's a key point.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of diversification, we touched on bases and how the U.S. military has planned to operate in the past and has operated Operation Desert Storm, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and in other operations. Do we want to continue to use the same assumptions that we have since the end of the Cold War for future operations, or at least to maintain our military posture, or do we want to move toward a more diversified posture that would, frankly, complicate Iran's targeting problem?
Mm-hmm.
To have bases perhaps across the depth of the Arabian Peninsula, bear bases that our forces could rapidly disperse to, which would make, obviously, Iran's targeting problem much more challenging, as well as bases around the periphery of the region that would be mostly out of reach of Iran's anti-access, their longer-range strike capabilities, mm-hmm. their short- and medium-range ballistic missiles, from where we could conduct long-range surveillance and strike operations against Iran.
Mm-hmm. This concept, Chris, we were talking again during the commercial break. Some folks are misunderstanding, I think, the intent that you have, that you're writing about in this report. What I took away was somewhat what Mark was alluding to, and that is rather than having several high-profile locations, a broader array of locations throughout the Middle East means that regardless of what might happen to any one or two of those locations, if they're threatened by Iran, we're still going to have a sufficient network of capability to be able to continue to conduct whatever operations are appropriate. Is that
exactly?
Is that fair?
I think, you know, one of the questions we received is, are you guys talking about pulling U.S. forces out of the Gulf or reducing our posture significantly in the Gulf? And our response to that is unequivocal no.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about diversifying our posture in the Persian Gulf. We're talking about perhaps altering our force mix that we keep forward in the Persian Gulf. But I by no means are we suggesting withdrawing forces from the Gulf. We're just trying to suggest a more survivable, a more operationally useful posture that takes into account the fact that the threat in the region has really changed. You know, Mark talked about a pacing threat. If you go back to the pacing threat of that 1979 assessment, it's a cross-border armored invasion with tanks mm-hmm. from either the Soviet Union or perhaps Iran or Iraq. Frankly, that threat really no longer exists in the region. What we have is a much different threat that requires a much different basing posture and a much different mixture of forces in the region.
Now, you mentioned force mix. Do we have in inventory now the equipment and personnel that we need to execute the force mix that you think is appropriate there?
Okay. The actual concept that we have published talks about operating from range from this more dispersed basing posture, not mm-hmm. just in the Persian Gulf, but perhaps in the southern tier of Europe, the Horn of Africa, the Seychelles, other bases that we suggest we would want to look at mm-hmm. in the future. And when we say operate against Iran, it means attack their anti-access air denial capabilities, not from a rollback approach, but go right to the heart of the matter to attack their command and control, to attack their weapons of mass destruction, their ability to orchestrate their offensive effectively, to create over time the air and sea superiority, pockets of superiority we would need to be able to enter the Strait of Hormuz, clear mines, and open the path into the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do we have the capabilities mix to execute such a concept? Well, we really don't have the bases today. We could. There are bases, military bases, and civil bases that we could look at
mm-hmm.
To implement such a concept. Our force structure, air forces, are very heavily weighted towards short-range capabilities, both manned and unmanned.
Mm-hmm.
And adjusting that mix to have a more balanced long and short range set of forces, I think, would be very important. DoD is beginning to do that
mm-hmm.
by funding what they call the long range strike family systems, which includes standoff attack capabilities from the sea as well as from the air and a new bomber.
Mm-hmm.
You also would want to take a hard look at the unmanned aircraft mix. The current UAV, unmanned air vehicle force that exists today, is primarily suited to operations in very permissive environments,
mm-hmm.
environments that we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, not against integrated air defenses that are emerging or exist in the Western Pacific today,
mm-hmm.
and that Iran is building.
Mm-hmm.
So we would want to look at procuring more longer range, stealthy kinds of surveillance and strike unmanned platforms that could operate over Iran.
We could dig into that on another level, and unfortunately we won't have time to, because we could go into what the status of the procurement chain is inside the Pentagon, which is, I imagine, as important or maybe more important than the actual technological capabilities of DOD and of the weapons developers that work with the Pentagon. Chris, your thought?
I think one important thing to add on to Mark's discussion about the range of our systems is that range not only allows us to operate from this more diversified posture, but once you're in Iranian airspace, presuming that you have an aircraft that is capable of penetrating inside a sort of non-permissive environment, that range then translates into persistence. And in a campaign in which mobile ballistic and cruise missile launchers will be a primary target of U.S. forces, those have been targets that have been proven to be rather hard to service. Especially, you remember the 1991 Iraq Scud hunt. It requires aircraft that can maintain persistent orbits, maintain a persistent ISR presence in the region to attack those targets. And these long-range aircraft these long-range strike family systems that Mark is suggesting could also be a key – their persistence could be a key characteristic for pursuing such a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about aircraft carriers, if we could. It's a perfect example, I think, of over time, the range of aircraft capable of flying off our aircraft carrier has been decreasing.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy has an opportunity to develop an unmanned capability with significantly greater range than current fighters, with stealth capabilities that could be very effective for surveillance, strike, and other missions over Iran. But I don't want to leave the impression with you or any of our listeners that it's all about air and sea.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an air-sea battle. This is a joint concept. And the Marine Corps Expeditionary Forces and Army Forces have a significant role in the kind of operation that we suggest in our report. And they would need to develop the kinds of capabilities they would need to operate in these A280 environments as well.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's hit that when we come back from the break on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, the capabilities Air Force and Marine Corps and work out a little bit more in the Navy side, too, on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guests are Mark Gunzinger and Chris Dougherty from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Navy Rear Admiral retired Elizabeth A. Height, Vice President, U.S. Public Sector Cybersecurity Practice, HP Enterprise Services, on the Cybersecurity Combating Threats to Our Software Environment panel, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard.
There are some incredibly sophisticated capabilities that can be unleashed in this commons called cyberspace that you will not be able to anticipate and you won't see coming. So part of your plan is to defend, part of your plan is to mitigate, and part of your plan is to recover.
Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective, and that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications. HP can help governments secure mission-critical applications by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. To learn more, visit federalnewsradio.com/HP.
Already this year, 6 federal agencies have offered buyouts or early retirements. Is your agency one of them? Check out federalnewsradio.com's buyout guide to see how slimmer budgets and changing priorities may be affecting you. Our buyout guide brings you the most up-to-date information on which agencies are offering buyouts, how many are offered, and who is eligible. Check it today and keep checking back for more information. Find it at federalnewsradio.com, search term buyouts.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
Richard Spires is the Homeland Security Department's CIO.
In the 2012 appropriations bill, a congressman put in a provision asking you for a kind of a software inventory.
Well, it was interesting because I heard about that by listening to the program there on Fed News Radio, and I was like, oh, and my name popped up, and I was like, well, this is interesting. So we can always improve. We're a large organization. We use a lot of different software products.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Conversation today revolving around a report released by the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments called Outside In, Operating from Range to Defeat Iran's Anti-Access and Area Denial Threats. And the authors of the report, Mark Gunzinger and Chris Doherty of CSBA, in studio with me to talk about it today. Mark, before the break, we talked about capabilities, and you expanded a little bit already on Navy and Air Force. Talk more about the Army and the Marine Corps and how they fit into this strategy, because a lot of the focus is on air and sea domination and not as much on ground, and I imagine that is causing some thoughts inside the Army and Marine Corps about where do we fit. Is that fair to say?
Yes, the Marine Corps and the Army are very interested in exploring their roles, their missions, and the capabilities they would need to operate in these in air-sea battle-like concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, we don't want to give the impression this is all about the air and sea. It's not. For example, in our report, we talk about potentially the need to execute a theater entry operation along the Strait of Hormuz to seize terrain that Iran currently operates from, the bases on the islands that are in the western approach to the Strait of Hormuz. And, of course, they enjoy a coastline mm-hmm. along the eastern side of the Strait of Hormuz. And that theater entry operation could be mounted to deny Iran the ability to use those locations to fire guided rockets, artillery, and anti-ship cruise missiles at our mine-clearing ships and, of course, commercial ships attempting to transit the strait. They might have to secure those locations, and that, of course, would require amphibious assault capabilities as well as air and sea power
mm-hmm.
That would continue to conduct deep strikes to prevent Iran from moving to reinforce those locations. It could include air assault forces from the Army to seize that terrain and hold it to permit the mine clearing to occur.
Mm-hmm. Chris, the operational capabilities that Mark is talking about, what's the status of those inside the Army and the Marine Corps? And again, I'm always interested in culture. This is a culture change, a little bit different worldview that I imagine that leaders inside both of those services will have to at least consider.
Right. The posture we've been discussing, thus far in the program has referred to, the 1979 review and countering armored forces. And I think if we look at the threats that constitute Iran's A2AD strategy, or A2AD with Persian characteristics as we refer to it, you see ballistic missiles, you see proxy forces, potentially armed with guided rockets, artillery, mortars, and missiles, and you see maritime exclusion capabilities. And in this region, given the tight confines of the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, there's actually a lot of role for ground-based units to contribute, even in a campaign that has a lot of air and maritime aspects to it. For example, the Army could certainly contribute large quantities of ballistic missile defense capabilities to the region. They could have a major role in training partner forces in the region to counter proxy forces, and particularly proxy forces armed with what we call GRAM, or guided rockets, artillery, mortars, and missiles. And additionally, I think there's a role for things like the Army Tactical Missile System to provide supporting fires and counter-battery fires against anti-ship cruise missile batteries on the southern coastline of Iran in support of a joint theater entry operation or just in support of a larger, broader operation.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that a little bit more when we come back. We're almost finished, and I have a question specifically about achieving some of these things that you're talking about. We'll do that to wrap up our conversation on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Chris Doherty, Mark Gunzinger, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, with me on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Meeting Mission Goals Through Health, brought to you by General Dynamics IT.
A new study of the benefits of electronic health records finds some early anecdotal evidence of major savings. The analysis by Bloomberg Government examined early EHR adopters like the Veterans Health Administration, which realized more than $3 billion in net benefits over 10 years, and Sentara Healthcare, which achieved a $50 million annual return on the investment in their EHR system. And the University of Pittsburgh Children's Hospital cut its serious medication errors by 92%.
General Dynamics IT is meeting the challenges of a complex healthcare environment that requires far-reaching experience and full-spectrum capabilities. Government, military, and commercial health payer organizations rely on General Dynamics IT's health services, solutions, and support to tackle their toughest issues. General Dynamics IT's broad understanding of healthcare data, military health missions, fraud, waste, and abuse protection, and more ensures support and innovation tailored to your real-world needs. Today's healthcare challenges are formidable. To learn more, go to GDIT.com.
Powered by the latest second-generation Intel Xeon processors, new HP ProLiant G7 servers are a perfect high-speed solution for lowering costs, improving utilization, and reducing server sprawl. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how together they can power your data center into the future. Talk to GovConnection's experienced federal sales team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
Hi, this is Carl Alsner of the Washington Capitals.
The green light for the linesman. Adam into the Washington zone. Coming down low, the shot, save made, that's it. Good morning, good afternoon, and good night, Buffalo. The Capitals with a win in the shootout, 4-3 over the Sabres.
Catch every minute of Caps hockey right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and online at federalnewsradio.com.
Agencies must move three IT systems to the cloud by mid-2012. Email and workplace collaboration applications are among the most popular early choices, with a number of agencies already successfully moving to web-based email. Which agencies are leading the way? What can other federal employees learn from their experience? Tune in to Federal News Radio Tuesday, January 31st at noon to hear answers to these questions and learn how agencies are taking advantage of the cloud. January 31st, noon, on Federal News Radio, sponsored by Google.
In the beloved fairy tale Beauty and the Beast, Belle and the Beast learn that true beauty is found within and live happily ever after. Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly one in three children in America are overweight or obese. Now is the time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. To learn more, visit letsmove.gov. Brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Ad Council.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests on Pentagon Solutions today, Mark Gunzinger and Chris Doherty of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, talking about their report called Outside In, Operating from Range to Defeat Iran's Anti-Access and Area Denial Threats. And we have links to the resources that go along with that report, including the report itself, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. I'll throw a question out there for both of you. Is it reasonable for me or any observer to be optimistic about the possibilities of executing what you're writing about in the context of looking at what happened literally under fire in Iraq and to some degree in Afghanistan, too, where the branches of the military, whatever mission they were tasked with, they were able to shift gears, do what was required, not just execute the mission, but let the Pentagon know, we need this equipment, here's how we need it, specifications and requirements and so forth, and actually get that equipment or forces in theater, execute the mission. When I think about that context, what you're writing about in this report seems eminently doable. Is that, am I on the right track there?
Again, yes and no. It's really not feasible to adjust the force mix and the posture and so forth under fire in this kind of a scenario. But I'm very optimistic that all of the services are working together to better understand anti-access and air denial challenges and what they need to do to cooperatively address those challenges.
Mm-hmm.
That's the official air-sea battle. is all about the Air Force and the Navy and now the Marine Corps and hopefully in the future the Army getting together to explore the synergistic relationships between their forces and how they could operate in support of each other to counter these challenges.
And that's something that's not just at the JCS level.
That's absolutely correct. This is the services getting together, understanding that, hey, these are problems that we have in common, mm-hmm. and the world is getting much more non-permissive. How are you, Navy, going to support me, the Air Force? Mm-hmm. How are you, Air Force, going to better support me, the Navy?
Mm-hmm. Chris, what should I take away? What is maybe the most important point or the two most important points that I should take away from reading this report? Give that to me, if you can, in 30 seconds or so as we wrap up.
I think I'd return back to what Mark said at the beginning of the program, and that is that this is a uniquely opportunistic moment wherein U.S. forces are shifting from the Gulf. The strategic environment of the region is changing quite rapidly, and at the same time, we're making some very serious budgetary decisions about what we're going to procure and what we're going to divest ourselves of in the coming years. And I think that having an operational concept like Outside In or like Air Sea Battle allows you a lens through which to focus your strategy down into actual capabilities. And I think, you know, that's the one thing that I would take away if I were you.
Mark, your thoughts?
Outside In is not about how we believe we should fight a war with Iran. It is about maintaining the U.S. military's freedom of action in that region and the kinds of concepts and capabilities and posture we might develop over the next 10 to 15 years to establish a more stable military balance in the region. We're certainly not advocating going to war with Iran, or for that matter, Air Sea Battle didn't do that for China.